From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. 75 years after the end of the Civil War, a group of writers hired by the Works Progress Administration set out to document American slavery from the points of view of its survivors. The slave narratives, as the resulting work came to be called, were based on the words of thousands of men and women enslaved by whites. It had become a powerful and well-known book. Now, a new book for the first time pairs the photographs of the interviewees of the slave narratives with their resulting interviews. The publication is stunning, haunting, and humanizing. My guest is Richard Kahan. He is a journalist who writes about photography, art, and history. He worked for the Chicago Sun-Times from 1983 to 99, primarily serving as the paper's picture editor. He's the author or co-author of more than a dozen books, several of which we've had him on to discuss on this program, including Un-American, about the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II, and Aftershock, The Human Toll of War, Haunting World War II Images by America's Soldier Photographers. Most recently, he spoke with us about The Revolution in Black and White, Photographs of the Civil Rights Era by Ernest C. Withers. He now joins me to discuss the book that he's co-edited with Michael Williams called River of Blood, American Slavery from the People Who Lived It, Interviews and Photographs of Formerly Enslaved African Americans. Welcome back to the show, Richard.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
So the original slave narratives were documented, as I mentioned, by these writers for the Works Progress Administration. Tell me a little bit more about that original text, which then formed the basis of this book that you've edited.
Well, it was an incredible project, part of the Works Progress Administration, like you mentioned. Not only did unemployed workers build dams and bridges and state parks, they also did a lot of humanities work, a lot of unemployed writers and newspaper reporters and teachers were hired by the government to document America in words. And I think their most important project was this project to track down and interview over 3,500 formerly enslaved men and women. So this was in 1937 and 1938. So every one of these people were at least 70 years old, even if they were born a baby just before the end of the Civil War. And most were in their 80s, some were in their 90s, and even a few of them were in their 100s. But what was remarkable about the project, well, there's a lot of things that were remarkable, but the candor, the bravery that these elderly people had in talking about their experiences. Usually they were talking to interviewers who were white, oftentimes white women. The interviews were kind of spontaneous. They were oftentimes living in their homes and somebody knocked on their door and asked for their experiences as formerly enslaved men and women. And it's the beauty of the words that attracted us first. But then we really concentrated on the 315 people who were photographed after those interviews. So the interviews would usually last for anywhere from about 15 minutes to an hour, sometimes even 2 hours. And at the end of the interview, these 315 people were asked to be photographed.
So just a small subset of those interviewed for the original slave narratives.
It was, and I'm not exactly sure exactly how, you know, why there were only 300, but at that time, photography wasn't as prevalent. And I think that they just found people who felt very comfortable, interviewers that felt comfortable with the camera. Mm-hmm. And they posed sometimes. It looks like sometimes they got on a suit or a jacket, but oftentimes they were just in their work clothes and they were photographed in their farm fields and oftentimes like leaning back on their rocking chair and sometimes even in the middle of their billowing sheets on a laundry line. So the pictures are very simple. They weren't taken by professional photographers, but by the people who the interviewers. But it's their simplicity and their kind of authenticity that really attracted us to this book. And I think when you see the pictures and you see the words next to it, every two-page spread is a photograph and excerpts from the interviews. It's very moving. It's very powerful.
So were these 300-some photographs ever published before together anywhere else?
Well, they've never they've been published in the midst of large textual books. So they're kind of illustrations of, used more as illustrations. They've never really been published to lead the book, in a sense, it's the photograph that readers look at first, and then it's the words. And they've never been paired with their words like this at all.
And so where did you find them?
Well, most of them are actually online. All this material was done by the government, and it was all donated, or not donated, but given to the Library of Congress. And that's where they are now. And the Library of Congress has a fantastic site. So if listeners want to look up Library of Congress and Slave Narrative Collection, they'll see the TypeScript transcripts of the interviews. And then they'll see, you know, when they have it, 1 out of 10 people, they'll see a little photograph.
So you gathered together the photographs, and then you found the interviews of those same people. Did you have trouble matching them up, or were they clearly identified?
No, there was no trouble matching them up. Okay. The key was that we wanted to find excerpts from these long interviews, these little important, I'm going to use the word nuggets, but that doesn't, it's almost like poetry, the very important things that they said. And then it was a matter of really organizing it, so that in a sense, it's almost like a conversation. The book looks at 96 people, and it's divided into different sections. So like the first section, everyone's talking about identity and their challenges with identity, not knowing when they were born, or not knowing where they were born, oftentimes being given a last name, on the day that they were set free. And then there's a chapter on what day-to-day life was like as in slavery, in bondage, and a chapter on violence, which is an important part of the book. But it's even more important is the wisdom that these people had, and the even sense of humor, and the lack of vengeance, I thought was really, really very interesting. But the book talks about the Civil War. It talks about the end of the war and the first days of freedom. And then it asks these people, looking back, their assessment of what life was like since they were freed.
So you chose out of the 300 plus photos that were available, just under 100, and then curated clips from or excerpts from the interviews. And it was interesting, and I'm wondering to read some of these excerpts of the interviews. Did you in any way adjust the writing, or was it all written down because so much of it is in the Black vernacular of the time?
Right. We left it in the Black vernacular. We left it there because I think that the words are important as they were. This is a very historic document. Mm-hmm. And for me to change it and to make it easier for readers, I think would not be a good idea. And we did.
And of course, we should warn people that there's a lot of instances of the N-word in there, which was
there is
used. Yeah.
We felt like it would be inappropriate to take it out. But we some of the dialect is a little bit. Sonali, tell me your experience of reading the dialect. Was it difficult, or did you catch on pretty quickly?
I mostly caught on. You get a rhythm after a while, and there was certainly right. some words that you had to sort of read twice. For example, the word never might be spelt as N-E-B-B-A-H, never. So it's sort of interesting to I think it just takes a little bit of reading. For me, it was maybe. Two or three pieces in, it seemed to flow, but I had to definitely read it in my mind. It's not something that you want to read out loud, I think. It's something you right. want to imagine in your head.
I agree. But once I think you do catch on, and I think it does take two or three times or two or three interviews, then you realize the beauty of the dialect too. It's kind of like when we were in high school and we read Huckleberry Finn, and at first the dialect was very off-putting. And if you had a good English teacher, he told you, just stick with it and it'll all come together. Because it's language, and so it does come together very easily.
Tell me about the name of the book, River of Blood. A very powerful and a violent image. Where's that from?
It is. It's from one of the interviewers, a woman by the name of Lou Williams, talks about how she remembers back in those days, and she remembers just the blood, the blood all over from beatings, and the blood on the ground, and the blood in the barns. And we were moved by that, but it sounds like a sensational title, but so many, five of the 96 people who are in the book talked about blood, their remembrance of blood. It was a very, obviously, a tremendously difficult time. And that's the the image that many people in their 70s, 80s, and 90s remembered from those days. And so...
So let's spell it out. We're talking about the blood of people who were essentially whipped by those who claimed to own them.
Right. That's exactly right. I'll read you the quote I'll read you an excerpt from her quote. She said, "We heard them holler and holler till they couldn't holler no more. Then they just sort of grunt every lick till they die. We find big streams of blood where he has whooped them. And when it rained, the whole top of the ground just looked like a river of blood." Mm. You know, it's important for people to understand that we weren't looking for the most violent, the most sensational accounts. And we also weren't scared of including these kind of accounts. We were looking for accounts that were very representational, very representative, I mean, of these narratives.
This is an issue that America has never truly come to grips with, right? We talk about slavery, the institution of slavery, in these abstract terms. And then even though there is documentation like the slave narratives, if it's missing the faces of the people who actually said those words, there's sort of an extra barrier that's there. Was your intent to help Americans face the human cost of slavery?
Well, our intention at first was to learn about it ourselves. And we learned so much from reading these narratives and looking at these pictures that, yes, we wanted to share that with people. We thought it was really important. I think one of the problems in education is that we learn about the Civil War in pretty much political terms, you know, the North against the South. We learn about it in kind of mercantile terms, about the, you know, growing cotton and how the North took the cotton and made it into fabric. But we don't read about it much in human terms. And I think that's what this book does. And as important as the words are, they take on a whole new life when you see, you know, you see a picture. One of the first pictures in the book is a man by the name of Bill Homer. And he's a thin, dignified man, and he's posing in front of what was a Texas county courthouse. And he describes the day that he was given away as a wedding gift by his slaveholder. And you read those words, and you go back to the picture, and it's then you look at the picture and you go back to the words. And I think that there's this. So Nali, tell me, is that how you read the book?
I mean, yeah, you definitely need to, in matching the faces of the people with the words, it's so hard to think about the dehumanization that needed to be done in order to treat human beings as objects.
Right, right. Yeah. Totally humanization. Slavery was based on keeping people down rather than encouraging them, you know, even... This sounds silly, but even if they were encouraged, the person who picked the most cotton would be perhaps rewarded at the end of the day. Never happened. It was only the opposite. The person who picked the least cotton got punished.
A lot of what jumped out at me was family separation. People who talked about being ripped away from their mothers at unimaginably young ages and then never saw them again, or wondering if other enslaved people they encountered might be brothers or sisters. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, there's so many accounts of families and how close families were, and accounts of slave auctions and seeing babies literally being taken from the breasts of their mothers as they were auctioned off into different places. One man by the name of John Fields talked about a day when he was 6 years old. And very dignified man, again, wearing a suit in Indiana. And he was 90 years old when he was interviewed. And he said when he was 6 years old, his master died and the heirs came in and divided the family six ways. And he said, "I never saw my mother after that for more than one evening." And you look at that picture and you kind of go up and back. And I think the pictures help the words become more real, maybe. And we're such a visual society that if it was just a book of words, it would be very important. But it takes on a whole new meaning when you see the photographs, I think.
Tell me about the women in this book. And we know, of course, that women who were enslaved were particularly vulnerable to sexual assault by the people claiming to enslave them.
Absolutely. And there's quite a bit of talk in the book about that. And there's talk about how late they had to be in the field when they were pregnant and how soon they had to return to the field when they were after they had given birth, and how sometimes they put their babies in little what's it called? Like a little hassock, a little, you know, they would hang them in a little bundle from the tree so their babies would be close to them while they were in the fields. I think that the role of women it's really explored pretty deeply in this book. As you know, one of the amazing things is we found from these 96 interviews that we think we covered most of the major issues, most of the major touchstones of slavery.
So there was the sexual assault. There was women simply trying to keep families together and trying to care for their babies. But what about we talked about the title River of Blood coming from these horrendous beatings. From the book's reading, were men and women sort of equally physically tortured?
They seemed to both be very vulnerable to it.
So it wasn't just the men, it was the women as well?
No, not just the men. Women were beaten just as, you know, from these accounts, there was certainly no, women talked a lot about their witnessing beatings of their loved ones and family members. One of the stories that really struck me is a woman who was given her freedom during the Civil War in St. Louis. And she was given her freedom papers. And instead of just being free in Missouri, she went down south so she could find her mother and her family. And what a harrowing experience of being an African-American woman. And she was, you know, she was, quote, caught and put on a slave block. And it wasn't until the very end that she took out her papers and showed everyone that she was free. And obviously, she had no idea whether those papers would be accepted. So the courage to go back into the South to find your family and the love of family, I think, really shines throughout the book.
So let's talk a little bit more about that. The declaration then that that they were freed by, you know, basically the people who owned them or claimed to own them. How did many of them take that? It seems as though for some, life sort of went on much as it was before. There wasn't this huge shocking change.
It did. I was very, I will talk about that, but I was also very moved by how difficult freedom actually came to so many people, that oftentimes plantation owners didn't want to tell their slaves that they were free because they had crops in the field. It was 1865 and they wanted to get the crops out. And sometimes they even conspired to wait a couple of years. One man says that his slaveholder told him that until he's 21, he's not going to be free, he and his brother. And it took a county judge to reverse that. So freedom wasn't easy to get. And once freedom was granted, boy, the challenges just began. They were living in an incredibly hostile environment. Why didn't they all move north, which was a little less hostile? You know, I think people have to realize they didn't have the mobility. These are people that, you know, didn't have access to trains and there weren't any cars. And most of them stayed on the plantation that they worked, and they were paid a pittance, which was better than they had before, but not much better. And others became sharecroppers on the plantations, on their old plantations or on the plantations very nearby. And that oftentimes put them in debt and made them in a sense slaves in a financial way.
By today's standards, we would have psychologists talking about the trauma of what these people experienced, PTSD. Back then, of course, those weren't terms that were used very often or even thought about. We didn't think about human psychology and the fragility and vulnerability and the scarring that happens. And so I can imagine that the people doing the interviews didn't really think to ask it. But does it come out anyway, the trauma of what these people experienced in terms of just impacting their futures post-freedom?
Absolutely. One of the chapters is called Trauma the Last Forever. And they did not talk about the trauma too much, although there were certainly mentions of suicide and there was mentions of Great Depression. But But most enslaved men and women left. They were never taught to read. They were never taught to write. They were never allowed to handle money. So it was very challenging for them to make a living.
And this is part of the fact that we've never had a proper reconciliation, because had there been a proper reconciliation, those things would have been acknowledged. There would have been some sort of reparation, some sort of price that America would have paid to the people that were devastated.
Right. There were very small pensions given, and I don't know too much about it, but several people talked about their Civil War pension, and not just the people who were in the army, but the pensions were tiny. The people who were interviewed were remarkably healthy, both physically healthy. I mean, they were in their 70s and 80s and 90s in the 19th century or in the early 20th century, and they seem to be remarkably psychologically healthy. These are very strong people who survived slavery and then survived 7 years after the Civil War. So it's an incredible group of people.
So let's talk about you have a section called near the end called The Pain of Reconstruction. What does that section try to capture?
Well, it talks about how difficult it was to get ahead in the world or to make a living for many. But also it talks about the incredible challenges. Many people talking about the Ku Klux Klan, talking about Jim Crow. One man talks about how one day he was on the street and he was just picked up kind of for vagrancy, and he spent 6 years in a chain gang. So it really, in a sense, talks about the seeds that affect African-Americans or affected the enslaved men and women then, and I think still are a part of our society today.
So they were freed and then they were preyed upon and attacked by hate groups and terrorist groups like the KKK, because of course a lot of that terror came after the end of slavery, and then of course we had segregation, and it was the end of one chapter, the beginning of another chapter of horror.
Absolutely, it was.
So let me ask you: when we look at what's happening today in our political landscape, our racism persists. America's by no means an anti-racist or non-racist country, and we've seen a resurgence of that under Trump. It's a topic we talk about a lot on this show. How much of it do you think stems back to this desire among especially white Americans to sweep away the history of slavery and post-slavery under the rug, because, well, I wasn't involved directly, so why should I acknowledge it or think about it or feel like I should pay any kind of a mental or real price for it?
Well, I think it's obviously very connected. We are taught as kids what a great country we are, a country of ideals. And as you get older, you realize how, I won't say how untrue that is, but how nuanced those declarations of the greatness of democracy are. And obviously, we have to reconcile ourselves about our Native American past, our past that involves slavery. And I don't think this book makes any bold political statement. It's really meant to just make us aware of the humanity and the humanity surrounding slavery. I think it's just remarkable that we in 2020 can open up a book and see photographs of formerly enslaved men and women and hear their words. And I know I learned a lot about the human toll of slavery. And I hope anyone who opens this book will be changed.
Richard, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Can't wait to see what you are working on next.
Thank you, Sonali. I appreciate it.
My guest is Richard Kahan. He's a journalist who writes about photography, art, and history. He has published many books that he's co-edited and edited, and we've been discussing his latest, co-edited with Michael Williams, called River of Blood, American Slavery from the People Who Lived It, Interviews and Photographs of Formerly Enslaved African Americans. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.